Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence, personal as well as her experience with the business of intelligence, is nonpareil, as far as I'm concerned, is our guest for a full hour today. She is Claire Lopez. She is Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy these days, but has had a career in intelligence, including as a clandestine service officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm very proud to say that she is the co-author with me of a new book titled See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense. Claire Lopez, welcome. It's good to have a chance to talk with you about this joint project and to otherwise illuminate the challenges that we discuss in it. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be with you.
I guess I'd start with sort of defining some fundamental terms here, Claire. Let's begin with Sharia itself. What does that mean? Are there various definitions of it? Does it mean basically whatever you want it to mean, or is there some particular rendering of it that is authoritative?
Well, Sharia is Islamic law. It is fixed. It is written down. It was codified by the senior scholars of Islam in the couple hundred years or so after we are told Muhammad died in the year 632. So, say by the 900s, by the 10th century, Sharia, the law, as well as the documents that it is derived from, that is, the Quran and the Hadith, primarily, were codified by the scholars. They were written down. They were other copies, other versions were literally destroyed, burned. So it is a fixed set of law that governs Islam. It governs every single action of a Muslim or a Muslim entity, like, let's say, a company. No, there are not different versions of Sharia. There is only one that is taught by the scholars in the universities, by the ulema, the senior clerics of Islam in the various countries. It is the only version written in the textbooks, including in the madrasas across the United States at Islamic centers and mosques. But it is enforced differently and to different degrees by different governments.
And I think it's fair to say that there are people in the Muslim world who may not have any firsthand knowledge of or experience with the requirements of Sharia. They may call themselves Muslims. How are they regarded by those who are, however, the authorities of the faith, say at Al-Azhar University and the like, Claire Lopez?
Well, I think it's likely that most Muslims in the world have some familiarity with Sharia, even if it comes to them only through someone else, like, let's say, the local imam at their mosque. They may not themselves even be literate, let's say, or have the knowledge to be able to read, to understand books of Sharia law. But most Muslims in the world are taught in some measure through their families, through their mosques, through their imams, what Sharia demands of them. And I think it's fair to say probably that most of them pretty much accept what they're taught. Whether they actually carry out the obligations of Sharia, which include, unfortunately, things like jihad against the non-Muslim, that is a whole other question. But I think that a belief system like Islam that has actually survived now for more than 13 centuries and has spread to include something like 1.6 billion adherents worldwide, that could not possibly happen unless the vast majority of Muslim mothers and fathers and teachers passed this along to their children over the centuries, and those children accepted it either passively or otherwise.
Our guest is Claire Lopez, Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy and co-author of our new book, See No Sharia. Claire, you introduced another term there that I think it's important to define right at the get-go as well, and that is jihad. You've indicated that it is the duty of Sharia-adherent Muslims to engage in it. What exactly does it entail?
Well, according to the books of law, and as you know, one of the ones we like to use most often is called Reliance of the Traveler, or Umdat al-Salik, a 14th century book of Shafi law, as it happens. The definition
It's not just a personal preference of ours. It has some standing, this book, The Reliance of the Traveler.
Oh, absolutely it does. I'm saying a preference because many of us find it convenient to use it. It is readily available at Amazon. It is divided into neat chapter headings that include one on jihad, but it is absolutely authenticated, certified, if you will, by the senior scholars of Islam, including Ad al-Azhar and other senior ulema around the Muslim world, and as well by the senior authenticating Muslim Brotherhood organization in the United States, which is the International Institute of Islamic Thought, sometimes called the IIIT. But in the section on jihad, it says that jihad is warfare against non-Muslims. And, of course, warfare can be many things, violent included, but not exclusively. And so when we talk about the global jihad movement, we're talking about a movement that includes the violent terrorism of an Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, Hamas, Hezbollah, but also all those forces that support it in any way, including by speaking, writing, broadcasting, certainly by funding, or even parents who teach jihad to their children, parents who send their children to a madrasa to learn jihad and sharia. Those are all ways of supporting jihad.
Now, Claire, there is a rather well-established narrative in the West, and I'd be interested in your thoughts as to how it has become so well-established, but that holds jihad actually is about personal struggle to become a better Muslim. In your readings of texts like Reliance of the Traveler and of course, the Quran itself and the other sacred text upon which Sharia is founded, is there a basis for viewing or understanding or practicing jihad in that manner as opposed to what you've described as the warfare against the non-believers?
No, none whatsoever. It is true that the Arabic word jihad means struggle, but within Islamic law, there is only a definition of jihad as warfare against the non-Muslim. There is in some hadiths, which are considered weak hadiths, of course, the sayings, the recountings of the actions of Muhammad, there are weak hadiths, meaning not given much authority by the scholars, that talks about jihad as a spiritual struggle. And indeed, perhaps, and we can certainly hope, that this is the way many Muslims choose to obey their faith. But in fact, jihad is warfare. There is no other definition of jihad in the law, in the Sharia. And indeed, as we know, the entire law itself, Sharia, comes from the second chronological set of verses in the Quran that Muslims believe were revealed to Muhammad after he moved, after the hijra from his home city of Mecca to Medina. And it is during that period of time in Medina when the more violent and the more aggressive verses of the Quran came to be. And it is from those verses that Sharia is derived, and therefore from that set of Sharia, the laws about jihad.
Claire, we have to pause for a moment. When we come back, I want to talk a bit more about the forms of jihad that are much in evidence now, if you know what to look for, in the West, including inside the United States government. That and more with my colleague Claire Lopez right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting with Claire Lopez, my co-author of our new book, See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's Front Lines of Defense. Claire served with great distinction in the front lines of our nation's defense as a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years. She is a recognized expert on matters involving national security in general and in particular those that we're discussing today, namely Sharia, this authoritative doctrine, very totalitarian in character, that is, according to its adherents, God's will that they impose it on the rest of us. And Claire, you talked about jihad, and you mentioned that violence is not the only way in which the objective of creating a world ruled according to Sharia by a religious figure, a caliph, if you will. What other forms of jihad are there, and what are particular concern, or should be, to us here in the United States?
Well, certainly from the writings of the Muslim Brotherhood senior leaders, theoreticians, and ideologues, we have the definition of jihad to include the civilization jihad. And of course, that term comes to us directly from a Muslim Brotherhood document called the Explanatory Memorandum, written in 1991 by a senior Muslim Brotherhood figure in the United States. And it was a kind of a report from the United States Muslim Brotherhood back to Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, was founded in 1928. And a key passage of this memorandum speaks of civilization jihad, the work, it says, of the mission of the Ikhwan, that's the Brotherhood, in America is like a grand jihad in destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands, meaning our hands. We're going to do this to ourselves.
We're visiting with Claire Lopez, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our vice president for research and analysis, and an extraordinary resource on national security matters. And Claire, you were just describing civilization jihad as laid out in this book, this memorandum that was introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial. There are those who have said that this book really has no standing, that the author was just sort of ranting, and that any inference that this is authoritative text describing the Muslim Brotherhood's agenda of, as you say, destroying Western civilization from within is the mere musings of a nobody. Describe the facts, both in terms of the author of this explanatory memorandum and the provenance by which this document was found.
Right. Well, the explanatory memorandum, as I said, was written in 1991 by a senior member of the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood at the time, Muhammad Akram, and it was a report back to the headquarters, if you will, of the Brotherhood organization in Egypt. And this individual, Akram, was a very senior member of the Brotherhood in the United States at the time. The report itself, it has come under criticism, and they'll say, oh, it means nothing, it has no standing, except for the fact that not only does it have parallels in other documents of the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's actually being carried out. Now, as you said, Frank, this document was discovered in a raid in 2004 on a townhouse in Annandale, Virginia, the home of
Ismail
al-Barasi, who was found with his wife on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge over the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland while driving, and she was seen by a couple of very alert troopers in a squad car filming the strut support systems of that bridge. Well, once they investigated the house, the townhouse in Annandale, Virginia, they discovered the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood in America. And that is where this document, the explanatory memorandum, was found, along with so many others that then were used by the Department of Justice in the prosecution of the Holy Land Foundation Hamas terror funding trial that concluded in 2008. And this was an organization ostensibly set up as a charity headquartered in Texas, but actually was channeling millions of dollars to Hamas. And for that, it was prosecuted. Its leadership found guilty, sent to long prison terms, and the organization shut down. But the important part about this is the documents that the judge in the case thought so important that he ordered them put online, which is how we come to be able to see them and to have them.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to the contents of this explanatory memorandum, Claire Lopez, what does it describe as the means by which the Muslim Brotherhood is waging this civilization jihad here in the United States from within, as they say, by our hands as well as the hands of the believers?
Well, the document is a kind of a report and a kind of a blueprint that, like I said, parallels other documents. For instance, the methodology of Dawah is one such parallel document. But talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood should set up organizations in the United States where the Muslim Brotherhood does not operate as a terrorist organization has been very careful not ever to cross the line of terrorism within the United States so that it can instead pursue the civilization jihad and, as it were, fly under the radar. So the document talks about setting up organizations in the social sphere of life in America. For instance, professional organizations, interfaith dialogue organizations, in order to loop in unsuspecting, well-meaning leaders of faith communities, Christian, Jewish, and especially those two others, perhaps, but those two in particular, professional organizations of various kinds. To set up, in other words, the structure within the United States that will support the introduction of Sharia gradually. And again, this reflects the ideology and the tactics, the strategy, really, of Sayyid Qutb, one of the senior ideologues of the Muslim Brotherhood, the gradualism, the milestones, to take the name of one of his books, step by step, set up the structures that will allow Sharia to be gradually accepted, first as a parallel legal system, or even in a cultural sense, and gradually gain more acceptance throughout society in all spheres, academia, media, of course, the government, as we know, so thoroughly penetrated by the Muslim Brotherhood. But this was the intent, and this was the report of the explanatory memorandum.
Claire, we're going to come back in a moment to a full-throated discussion of the penetration of the U.S. government by the Muslim Brotherhood and what that has meant for our policies. I just want to mention sort of in passing that one of the things that we have watched now with growing horror, I think, is evidence of how this sort of infrastructure building, if you will, that Sayyid Qutb recommended, this incremental creation of the conditions for jihad of the violent kind through the civilization phases and milestones is playing out in Europe. And I want to discuss with you, you know, insights and lessons from there. But we'll talk more about all of that and much more in this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio with my colleague Claire Lopez of the Center for Security Policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's become a blood sport in Washington lately to deride as conspiracy theorists those who have documented the efforts of the Muslim Brotherhood in its words to, quote, destroy Western civilization from within, unquote. I am among those who have refused to be silenced by the conspiracy deniers. In fact, the U.S. government has established in federal court that the Brotherhood's front groups have long pursued a stealthy campaign to penetrate and undermine our constitutional republic. Not surprisingly, Islamists and allied leftists are particularly aggressive in denying this conspiracy. Some on the right, however, would have us believe that despite ample evidence to the contrary, the Muslim Brothers have not been able to infiltrate the conservative movement and the GOP. Regrettably, that's not true. Pretending otherwise simply enables that Islamist assault on the right and our country to continue. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn much more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are having a very, very important conversation about jihad in America, the specific jihad in our crosshairs at the moment is of a civilization kind, namely that practiced by the Muslim Brotherhood, a kind of incremental, stealthy, subversive, seditious form of this jihad aimed at exactly the same purposes as the violent kind, namely our submission to the doctrine its adherents call Sharia. With us to discuss all of this is a friend and colleague of mine, I'm very proud of saying, our vice president at the Center for Security Policy for Research and Analysis. She has been extraordinarily productive this year in helping us generate a number of products and books that have addressed various aspects of this phenomenon of civilization jihad. In fact, we call it the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. She is, of course, Claire Lopez, a former career clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. And Claire, you were talking a bit about the approach that builds infrastructure or structures, if you will, that can be used to achieve this ultimate triumph of Sharia. Talk for a moment before we get to the United States and the focus of our new book, See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense, about insights in all of this that we should take away from what we've learned so far about recent unpleasantnesses in Europe.
You know, as we were talking before about the Hijra, the original Hijra, the movement of Muhammad and his few followers from Mecca to Medina, that movement, that Hijra, from a place where he was not succeeding very well to a place where he became very successful through jihad in growing Islam, is paralleled today by the movement of large numbers of Muslim migrants from places of the Middle East and North Africa into Europe. And some of that was deliberately invited after World War II as Europe desperately needed labor to rebuild and so forth. But what has happened more recently and become obvious is that too many of those incoming migrants were allowed to set up enclaves. In Paris, it would be in the banlieue, the suburbs of Paris. In Brussels, for instance, we've seen this place called Molenbeek, a neighborhood in the center of Brussels, where Muslim populations were permitted to live without assimilating into the host society, or, importantly, without being part of the legal system. In other words, that the local law enforcement, the local security services, basically took a hands-off approach to these enclaves, and as that developed, they became enclaves of Sharia. They were apart. They were outside the writ of the law of the state. And Molenbeek is certainly an example of this, the place where these attackers came from that attacked both in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo attacks of January 2015, the later attacks in Paris in November 2015, and then more recently, as we've seen in Brussels early this year, 2016. And so those attackers came out of these enclaves. And that is the model, I think, that some of the ideologues within the Muslim Brotherhood, within Islam, have in mind when they talk about a civilization jihad. It is to set up structures, be they actual physical neighborhoods like Molenbeek, or the structures within society, in places of work, in academia, as we've talked about, on university campuses, within the media, within the U.S. government even, that seek stealthily, as you just said, Frank, and incrementally to introduce Sharia and to have that allowed by the authorities to achieve a hands-off a status that the authorities so gradually become anesthetized to its introduction and growth that they allow it to happen and grow as this is we've seen played out in Europe. We cannot allow that to happen here in the United States.
Claire Lopez, one of the things that is a manifestation of this phenomenon, as you've indicated, is something that I guess sort of the colloquial shorthand for it is a no-go zone. These enclaves that have become essentially off limits, or at least very dangerous for even armed, police officers to enter. There is a concern that, as you say, to the extent this same trajectory is what the Brotherhood and other Islamic supremacists have in mind for us, that we might have similar kinds of areas that are essentially unassimilated, Muslim only. And again, this isn't about Muslims per se. This is about Muslims who embrace this doctrine of Sharia and therefore this Sharia-driven, jihadist-enabled supremacist program in mind. Do you see evidence in our own country of such enclaves being established as well?
Well, certainly we have indications that there are places where such places are beginning to show these characteristics. For instance, in Phoenix, Arizona. For instance, in Minneapolis or the Twin Cities area, particularly Minneapolis of Minnesota. Are places.
You were just up there and doing a little bit of on-site investigating of your own. Did you see evidence along these lines?
Exactly. Well, I actually went on a drive through one of those neighborhoods in Minneapolis called Cedar Riverside, which are the names of two intersecting streets that bound this particular neighborhood. And I was told that these are places that are exclusively in Minneapolis, so it happens, Somali, Muslim. And unfortunately, now this is a neighborhood that has been on more than one occasion an exporter of jihadis who've left the United States and gone over to places like Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab, an al-Qaeda affiliate, or to the battlefields of the Middle East to join up with the Islamic State. As a matter of fact, as I was in Minneapolis those several days ago, several would-be jihadists were actually on trial in Minneapolis for just such an intent to go over and fight with the enemies of the United States, even young men who were born in the United States, maybe first generation or even second generation of immigrants from Somalia. But because we do not vet our refugee populations or immigrant populations for ideology, for suitability to blend into a Judeo-Christian-based legal system in this country, to abjure allegiance to their the legal system of their birth, Sharia, and to instead pledge allegiance only to the Constitution. We don't do that. We don't ask for their ideological motivations or intent or proclivities. They're not allowed to do that. That is part of, I would say, the success of the civilization jihad in the United States, that our officials are no longer even permitted to think or use words that would help them to properly vet potential incoming immigrants or refugees.
This is evidence of a much larger problem, which is, of course, the subject of our focus in Sino-Sharia, countering violent extremism, and the disarming of America's first lines of defense, Claire Lopez. We have to pause again. When we come back, I want to explore how this has come to pass inside our government, this blinding of our first lines of defense, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the military, the intelligence community, and what the implications of it might be if it's allowed to go uncorrected. That and much more with our guest, Claire Lopez of the Center for Security Policy, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our fourth segment in this very important conversation with my colleague, Claire Lopez, our Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. She is the co-author with me of See No Sharia, a brand new book about what has happened to our own government, our first lines of defense, as a result of the sorts of civilization jihad the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic supremacists have been waging so effectively, largely unknown to most of us here inside our country. And Claire, you were describing sort of one example of a kind of willful blindness on the part of some of our, well, first lines of defense. How has this come to pass inside the United States government? Is this really just another example of the subversive, stealthy practice of the Muslim Brotherhood, and one that has particularly ominous consequences?
Well, yes, it really is. Let's go back to the attacks of 9/11, right after which our government responded appropriately and very aggressively against those who'd attacked us, in a physical sense, of course, going to topple the Taliban in Afghanistan and rout out al-Qaeda from there. But at the same time at home, under the administration of President George W. Bush, the Muslim Brotherhood and figures, top figures within the Brotherhood in America, had already and long since penetrated the top levels of our national security. And evidence of that was the day after 9/11, when President Bush went to the big Islamic Center of Northwest Washington, D.C., and spoke inside of that mosque with cameras and photographers all around him, and intoned the words that would set the tone from that point forward about going after the Islamic terrorists that had attacked us on 9/11. And he said, "Islam is a religion of peace." And as we look at the photos from that day, standing all around him were top leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. Notably, off of his left shoulder, within inches of the president, is Nihad Awad, the executive director of CAIR, Council of American Islamic Relations, which, of course, is Hamas doing business as CAIR in the United States. Nihad Awad, along with the other founders of CAIR, of course, having been one of the top leaders of Hamas in the United States at the time of the founding of CAIR. So the president is surrounded by these influence operators, I would call them, agents of influence. And those words, "Islam is a religion of peace," really set the tone.
Yeah, how on earth did that happen? I mean, this is right after 9/11, as you say. Presumably, the president of the United States and the people around him would have been more alive to the danger of jihad than at any other time in the immediate wake of that horrible terrorist attack.
They'd already been penetrated and suborned going way back. I mean, literally, the Muslim Brotherhood came to America right after World War II. And there's a picture online, a famous photo of President Dwight D. Eisenhower in the Oval Office meeting with a delegation of Brotherhood individuals coming from Egypt in 1952. But beginning, let's move it up to the Clinton administration, we had senior Brotherhood, and as it turns out, Al-Qaeda operative in the United States, Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, who penetrated all the way to the Oval Office. And that continued through the influence operations of such top Brotherhood affiliates as Grover Norquist, Suhail Khan, and Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi as well, in the all the way into the Bush administration. So the penetration operation was well advanced by the time 9/11 hit. And even though the military response was quick and decisive, the more important and, as we said before, insidious influence of jihad and of the Brotherhood promoting Sharia was hard at work behind the scenes, and that crippled our response in the long term. And beginning, like the book, our new book, See No Sharia, says, by taking aim at the language, the lexicon, and our ability to speak freely about where this threat came from. It didn't come as a bolt out of the blue, even though that's how 9/11 felt. It came from an ideology, and that ideology is Sharia.
Claire Lopez is our guest, the co-author with me, as she mentioned, of See No Sharia. And Claire, bring this up to the moment. As we look at the cumulative effect of this penetration and influence operations going back, as you say, in earnest to, well, I think of it as Grover Norquist's enabled penetration of the Bush administration. But under the Obama administration especially, we've had this series of steps taken with respect to the lexicons that the various agencies are allowed to use, words that are not permissible. We've had, of course, training, including that you have conducted in some cases, interfered with, and trainers and materials purged. We've had the introduction of this term countering violent extremism. Sort of give us a flavor of what all of this has actually meant in practice.
Right. Well, I think the great purge, as we call it, of the training and the curriculum in the U.S. government was especially detrimental and a pivotal moment, really, in this struggle. Although the purge of the language and the change in the lexicon began under the Bush administration, I think that that administration was more or less unaware. They didn't really understand what this was about. But come up to the Obama administration, and they know perfectly well what they're doing and have chosen proactively to ally themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood, to bring Brotherhood figures into the administration as advisors and appointees, preferentially over any other Muslims who are not affiliated with the Brotherhood. And so we saw a very determined agenda carried out under the Obama administration, which includes, of course, as we've said, the Great Purge beginning really 2011, 2012 in earnest, when books and presentations and language and certainly training curricula across the government throughout all the cabinet departments were purged of any references that would associate Islamic terrorism with the inspiration that drives it from Islamic law and doctrine and scripture. And that had a huge effect on the ability of the U.S. government and our first lines of defense, which would be the intelligence community, CIA, DIA, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, to know and to recognize, to name the enemy, and then to formulate and implement effective strategies to defeat that enemy, the global jihad movement, all who support jihad in any way, including the Brotherhood. So we were crippled from that point onward, and it began with the language. The language was so important.
Yeah. And speaking of language, just give us quickly a translation of countering violent extremism.
Right. This term comes into play during the Obama administration, and it is a substitute concept, if you will, for the original drive to go after the enemy wherever the evidence would lead, which was the way we did it right after 9/11. Pursue the evidence where the evidence leads. If it leads to Islamic Jihad, then that's the enemy doctrine. Well, countering violent extremism introduced with the help of Muslim Brotherhood advisors, who, by the way, were responsible for advising all of the U.S. government on the purge of the language. And then through their influence, this term was introduced instead. What is violent extremism? Well, it's anything anybody wants it to be. It's a completely anodyne term that means precisely nothing, which is the intent.
Or it means that actually there are violent extremists about whom we should be at least as worried as any other, namely constitutionalists, veterans, gun owners, Tea Party activists, and the like. Claire, when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more on the practical implications for public safety and national security of what's happened. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're finishing up this very important hour-long conversation with Claire Lopez, one of the most thoughtful and, I think, most effective explainers and analysts and, well, practitioners of national security policy when it comes to matters involving specifically the jihad, the global jihad movement. I'm very proud that Claire and I collaborated on this new book, really the result of the work of a number of members of our team, but we get the credit for it. See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense. And Claire, you were just sort of bringing forward in a very distilled fashion a central problem that we have so now obscured the nature of the enemy and its purposes, that we've essentially rendered our, well, as we call it, first lines of defense, unable to counter or even really to grasp what they're about. What does that mean in practice? What, from your experience with the intelligence community, with the military, with the diplomatic corps, with the law enforcement community, what does this in practice mean?
Well, I'll speak to the last one especially, Frank, the law enforcement community, because I do a lot of teaching and training of law enforcement across the country. And because law enforcement at the police department or the sheriff department level are so closely dependent on the federal government, not just for funding, but also for information and for training, they are now deprived of real and targeted, accurate information about the enemy in ways that hamper, cripple even, their ability to get ahead of jihadist activity in their own communities even before something violent occurs. And so what that means is that instead of being allowed, for instance, to monitor what is going on inside of mosques identified as Muslim Brotherhood mosques or dominated by, let's say, a leadership, including imams that espouse and preach and teach Sharia and jihad, instead of being allowed to monitor those, they are forbidden to monitor them. And so when something happens, and when something happens, it's always in somebody's community, and the first line of defense is not the CIA or the FBI, it is local law enforcement. They are bereft. They are without the tools that they need to get ahead, to preempt jihadist developments in their communities before something violent happens, or even to prevent, as we were talking about in Minneapolis, young men from being recruited out of the mosques and then sent elsewhere on suicide bomber missions or to join jihadist organizations overseas.
You know, Claire, a case study of this, of course, has been what's befallen the New York Police Department just in the past couple of months, long the gold standard, really, in terms of local law enforcement. What has lately come to pass as a result of pressure, I believe, from the Obama administration and certainly the direction of Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, to the NYPD?
Yeah, certainly. Unfortunately, I mean, the NYPD, as you say, has long been the premier U.S. police force at the forefront of the fight against jihad and Islamic terrorism. But under pressure from the Brotherhood and our own government under the Obama administration, they too have been forced to curtail, to change, to alter their training. A very important study came out in 2007 called Radicalization in the West by the NYPD, which very accurately identifies Islamic jihad as Islamic and as inspired by the ideology of Sharia. They understood this very well and wrote it. That particular document, they have been forced to withdraw it from not only their teaching curriculum, but their website and any use, any official use by the police department.
You know, it's kind of been disappeared like Trotsky by the Soviets. And the again, I'm interested in trying to communicate, Claire, to our audience what this means for them. I mean, what are the consequences for both public safety and the national security that we now have a much wider degree of latitude for these civilization jihadists to build that infrastructure and perhaps turn it to the next phase in the milestones, namely the violent jihad?
Well, exactly. I mean, one example of this, take it over to Boston, where, of course, the Tsarnaev brothers that committed the atrocity attacks on the Boston Marathon in April of 2013 were associated with a local mosque, the Islamic Center of Boston, which we know was founded, at least one of the trustees was Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the senior jurist of the Muslim Brotherhood and others like him associated with that mosque, that Islamic center. And when then FBI Director Robert Mueller was asked in open session of Congress, well, what about this mosque? Did you go there? Did you even know about this mosque? Did you have any knowledge of it? Oh, he says, yes, we did. We conducted outreach with them. He didn't say we investigated them for potentially jihadist encouragement from the imams. No, they were doing outreach. This is the result.
Well, and again, let's talk about that outreach. And as it happens, Claire Lopez, our conversation is taking place in proximity to the day on which Muslim Brotherhood front groups, now operating under an umbrella they've created called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, has been sort of flexing its muscles on Capitol Hill. Give us, again, brief, kind of what this means in practice, the outreach and the access being given to these influence operators against legislators and law enforcement and other government officials.
Well, what it means in practice is that senior law enforcement, police chiefs and sheriffs, instead of considering the evidence and where the evidence leads to potentially seditious encouragement to jihad by local imams, they instead have been co-opted by those imams, by those Islamic centers with which they're affiliated, as almost partners. And those local imams will say something like, well, we will help you to understand the terrorism, the really bad guys that do the violent attacks. We'll help you understand those. No, it's got nothing to do with Islam. And therefore, the law enforcement is co-opted into a kind of a partnership, much as in the interfaith dialogue movement with faith leaders, co-opted into a relationship that then has them prioritizing the relationship with these potentially, possibly seditious purveyors of jihad and sharia, instead of viewing them as someone to be investigated, or at least at a minimum to be monitored in what used to be called the global war on terror.
This is really chilling stuff, Claire Lopez. Few people in the country understand it as well as you, and thanks to your understanding of it, you're helping the rest of us become more knowledgeable about it. I'm particularly grateful to you for your work on the Civilization Jihad Reader series, which our new book is part of, See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense. Like all of the other books in this series, it is available to you for free online if you choose to download it there or simply read it. Or you can purchase it, of course, at Amazon. I hope you will, one way or the other, take this information aboard and take advantage of the great resource that Claire Lopez is. Thank you for your time today, Claire, and I hope you will keep up the good work. Come back to us again very soon, as I hope will the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.